This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Mark Como, good afternoon. This is Nick Francis, who's along with his brother Mark. Hi. He's produced Black Gold, this documentary at the London Film Festival. To get any kind of distribution for a documentary like this must be devil's own job.
Can be, I think. Now that so many more documentaries are being made, partly because of the accessibility, the technology to get the project off the ground, it's very, very difficult to find an audience outside of a traditional television broadcast. That said, television has changed so much that it's encouraged so many people to look outside of TV to make films, and that's how Black Gold came about. We made this film without a broadcaster on board and made it over a three-year period, bringing together kind of putting a project together which you wouldn't normally do if you're working directly for a broadcaster. And I think so many films that we've seen this year at different film festivals have had to do exactly that. A big question, though, for documentaries now in the cinema, many that you'll see or have seen haven't been funded in the traditional way.
Thing is, Mark, this isn't, I'm sure it's not a polemical piece. This isn't an authored piece. This hasn't got Michael Moore taking us through it.
And you say that like it's a bad thing.
No, saying, you know, this is the way you should interpret the facts. I mean, you basically take us round and say, here you are, this is the situation, what do you think?
Sure.
Is there more of a market for people to actually go to the cinema and see that rather than watch it on the TV?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, firstly, I should say I haven't seen the film, I said at the LFF. We're in an interesting state with documentaries at the moment. A few years ago, documentaries didn't make it into cinemas at all. Then, partly as a result of what happened with Nick Broomfield and Michael Moore and more recently Morgan Spurlock, people did start seeing windows for them and they did start making their way into the cinema. The question is, what makes a documentary cinematic? I mean, what is it about something like Capturing the Freedmans that means that it probably should be seen in a cinema as opposed to, I mean, it's a very good piece of work I saw recently about the bass player of the New York Dolls, which is a lovely film, but it was basically a television film. And it's something indefinable. Some things work in the cinema. I mean, I was really surprised in saying that Morgan Spurlock's Supersize Me worked as well as it did in the cinema, because I remember seeing that on a rough tape version in Cannes and thinking, this is a great television program. I really like that documentary, but I was amazed by how well it did in the cinema. I never thought of it as profoundly cinematic.
So what is it, Nick, then, that makes this a cinematic experience as opposed to a televisual one?
I think there's 3 points. I think the first thing is, I think the way how you cut a film, how you make it and how you shoot it, television requires some basic elements. And you know, if you watch any television program, the story is told to you in the first 30 seconds what you're going to have over the next hour. In cinema documentaries, the story unfolds over the 80 minutes and takes the viewer or the person in the audience on a journey, and they are totally different demands. If you talk to a television commissioning editor or you talk to a distributor who puts out cinema films, what they require is absolutely different. So what we try to do with Black Gold is, you don't know what's going to happen at the beginning of the film. You go on a journey and 80 minutes later, you come out with load and load of questions. It's not about giving everything away in the first 30 seconds. And I think the devices that you use for cinema are different than that you use for television.
You should remember also, I mean, that the cinematic tradition of documentary filmmaking is very open-ended. I mean, you think about something like Hearts and Minds, which caused such a stir and was really... I mean, we had, you know, the guy who directed Hearts and Minds in on the programme, and it is a very, very open-ended piece of work. And consequently, there was something cinematic about it. I think if you go into something thinking, I'm making a film, it is profoundly different to going into it and thinking, I'm making a TV movie that, you know, could get some kind of theatrical platform.
On a text, Nick, can you please tell us how to purchase coffee direct from producers at a fair price?
there's many, many ways. I mean, our website is acting as a kind of gateway at blackgoldmovie.com. We found that accidentally thousands of people every week go there and ask those similar questions. And, you know, it's inspired, say, in the States, thousands of coffee shops to link up with the film so that when it goes into the city, like tomorrow, tonight actually opens in Chicago, there are coffee shops around the whole of Chicago promoting the film and capturing the interest of people who go into the cinema. They walk out and they say, what do we do? So without kind of listing a whole load of companies in this country who do some, you know, different kinds of coffee, I would say, you know, search. Because there are some people who do, there's a whole variety of different things, but our website would be a good place to start.
It should be said that it was only a few years ago, if you wanted to buy coffee that had been sourced and funded properly, it tasted rubbish. Yeah. But, I mean, that's not, you know, so you ended up by saying, no, can I have proper, you know, a proper coffee and I'll give some money to a good a good cause.
Yeah.
That isn't the case now, is it?
Well, no, it started off as, like, and I think that's...
It's all from Nicaragua, I think, as I remember. It just tasted terrible.
I think that's where the challenge of the fair trade movement. It's not about, it's trying to say, this isn't about charity, it's about business. And, you know, you just pay something, you get a reasonable guarantee that people haven't been exploited. But the guy in our film says, you know, even the fair trade price is not enough. Yeah. The idea that if everyone went out and bought fair trade coffee tomorrow, the problem would be solved isn't necessarily the case. It's about finding out how much of your cup of coffee. I mean, the rough equation that's always cited is for a $3 cup of coffee, a farmer gets less than 3 cents. That may be a few cents more if you buy a fair trade cup of coffee. But there are some companies going well beyond all of that stuff. And I think what we try and do in Black Gold is not necessarily say, you know, this is about buying fair trade coffee. It's about making you as a consumer just think about your interaction with the rest of the world and make it relevant to what's going on,
normally,
in your own life.
Mark normally brings me a coffee. I was thinking, well, I wonder if, you know, it's going to, because that's going to be a challenging and embarrassing moment, because obviously Nick would then say, well, where'd you get that from?
Shall I tell you why I didn't bring you a coffee?
Because you're too tight.
No, because they didn't screen the Texas Chainsaw Massacre at the beginning in a timely enough fashion for me to see it at a normal press show. So I just had to pay to go and see it in the West End before dashing here to get here for the programme. So blame the Texas Chainsaw Massacre at the beginning for your lack of caffeine.
Right, okay. Nick, so wish you all the best with this. What do you do next? It's been such a big part of your life.
It has. It's difficult to even answer that question.
Move on.
Well, it's difficult. I mean...
Sell out. Work for Michael Bay. You
know, we could try. It's opening. I mean, tonight we go to Rome, open it there, and every single week over the next six, it's opening in different cities. Right, so at the moment, this is full time, and hopefully in the new year, we'll start on our next project.
Nick, wish you all the best. Nick Francis, Black Gold, just in London at the moment, but hopefully with a bigger distribution deal to come.
Yeah.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. And you can check the website if you need some more details on that. 11 minutes past three. Now, we'll do the box office top 10 movie reviews coming up. Of course, we've got no idea whether Tony Blair and Bertie Ahern are going to pop up. So we'll just charge forward and see what happens.
They're just waiting for us, you know. They're just sitting there with a little tranny going, should we go on now? No, he hasn't started the gun.
We'll do some reviews of The Guardian and History Boys and The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Beginning, as it cost me my cup of coffee.
Yes.
Right, first of all, at 10, Talladega Nights.
The Ballad of Ricky Bobby. You're not going to say that bit.
I can't be bothered.
Okay, well, no, I can't be bothered either. I mean, it's going now. Thank you very much. It's Will gone. Ferrell. Mm.
Little Miss Sunshine, this week's number 9.
I mean, I'm surprised by how long it's hung on in there. It has got fantastic reviews and better reviews than it perhaps deserves. There are good things about it, but it's nothing like as edgy as it needs to be.
Accepted at 8.
Which, you know, it's... It may be that everybody thinks that things were better in their day, but, you know, when I was a kid, we had Animal House, and we had Porky's, and we had Lemon Popsicle, and now you have Accepted. I mean, I really like the American Pie movies. I just don't think this is up to snuff. It's like, it takes more intelligence to make a really good dumb teen comedy than this has.
Children of Men, this week's number 7.
Very good, very grim, very dark, nicely shot, interesting take on, you know, dystopian future England, and a terrific movie. Obviously never going to be a massive crowd pleaser, but it has done very well.
The Queen, at number 6.
Yes, it'll come out on video soon, and then you can watch it on the television, where it's clearly designed to be. I've got nothing against the performances, I've got nothing against the script, in fact, the main guy, you know, I keep wanting to call him Martin Sheen. And he's very, very good as Tony Blair. But
Michael Sheen.
Michael Sheen, yes. I saw him on stage the other day, actually, playing David Frost, and he was brilliant at that as well. But it's not a film.
And we have World Trade Center at number 5.
Which I like more than most people. I understand people thinking that it's sentimental, but I think that there is a time and a place for sentimentality. And I would like to say for the umpteenth time that just because one of the characters in it is a right-wing patriotic soldier who says somebody has to pay for this and then goes off to fight in Iraq does not mean that that is the view of the film or the director. Characters do not necessarily speak the voice of the film.
This email from Nick Wilhoft. Writing from the Ogilvy Health World Medical Education, 100 Avenue of the Americas, New York.
Wow.
Simon and Dr. Kermode, always look forward to the movie review on my Monday evening commute from New York to the burbs of New Jersey. I am sure Oliver Stone's politics are deliberately placed in World Trade Center. The American people were misled into thinking Iraq was all about payback for 9/11. It was a different emphasis to that seen in the UK. Their awakening to that aspect of the false pretext has been gradual but real. Oliver Stone did irony. with the Marine.
He did, a solid citizen
with no redneck tendencies, heading off to Iraq for payback.
Well, I think that's the most intelligent thing I have heard about that, and congratulations, that's exactly right. And
what you mean, because he agrees with you?
I mean, he happens to say the thing that's right, and obviously I am always right. But he said it in a far more eloquent way than I would have done, and moreover, he said it from America.
Yes, I do. World Trade Center at 5, then. Hoodwinked at 4.
You know, more postmodern kids' fairy tales for adults, but, you know, a little bit of kids' fun in there. I mean, I just, you know, make kids' films for kids. Kids' films for kids are great, and then they're timeless, and then they'll last. And you know what? Adults can watch them as well. It's fine. You don't have to spend every minute of a children's film nodding and winking at the grown-ups going, oh, I know you saw The Postman Always Rings Twice, so did I.
Click at number 3.
The great and majestic career. It's not a great top 10, is it? A career of Adam Sandler. Plot is he gets a remote control that controls his life, and he discovers that, in fact, if he just learnt to slow down a little bit, hit the pause button a bit more often, things might work out better than it. Another madcap performance by Christopher Walken, obviously doing an imitation of the mad scientist from Back to the Future, but not doing it with any of the wit or pizzazz of the original.
The Departed is number 2.
Martin Scorsese, back on form to some extent. I mean, a rip-roaring, edgy crime thriller, edge-of-your-seat stuff, pretty empty. At the end of it, you're not left with the kind of sense of, you know, chaotic bafflement that you were after the Hong Kong original. And some people have sort of been a bit annoyed that I wasn't more down on it, because I've been generally so down on remakes of Hong Kong movies. But I think this is, as Hong Kong remakes go, it's pretty honourable, partly because they really do try and make a whole nother movie. I mean, it's not like the forthcoming remake of The Grudge, which again is the same director, Takashi Shimizu, or like, you know, Gore Verbinski's horrible rehashing of the Ringu movies. It is a good movie. It just happens to have the ghost of this Hong Kong movie behind it.
UK's number 1 is The Devil Wears Prada.
The Devil Wears Prada. That's Ken Russell's 1970s film, but redressed by a modern stylist. And that
might work.
I would pay good money
to see.
That's
an idea.
So you want me to do the proper one?
Well, you might
as
well.
It's fine. Anne Hathaway, who's getting a lot of flack, is perfectly fine, because the thing you have to understand about The Devil Wears Prada is it's not a grown-up movie. It's a PG certificate movie that is aimed primarily at teenage girls, and their point of identification is Anne Hathaway, and it's in much the same way as Princess Diaries, actually. It's a story of a young girl's journey into a strange other world in which she discovers, you know, things that she didn't know. The things that she discovers happens to be Muriel Strepsil dressed from head to foot in Prada, which is fine, and Muriel is fine for every minute she's on screen. But it's not the savage indictment of the fashion industry that some people claimed it was. But hey, I don't think it ever meant to be.
By the way, you are absolutely right. This is the same Mark Kermode who was on Extras last night. Quite extraordinary comedy performance, I thought. Well done.
What, the one line?
Yeah, he joined Jermaine Greer and Mark Lawson on the Newsnight Review sofa, reviewing Andy Millman, who, of course, is Ricky Gervais's fictional sitcom. It went like this.
Andy Millman as Ray Stokes in a scene from BBC One's new sitcom, When the Whistle Blows. The catchphrase is, are you having a laugh? Did you, Jermaine Greer?
Oh, for goodness sake, why me? Why do you make me watch this stuff? This was sexist, misogynistic, Neanderthal garbage. It was nothing but really nasty sub-carry-on innuendo. And it seems that this talentless Millman individual also wrote the script. It's supposed to have a writer.
I think he needs a defender, Mark Kermode.
Oh, I think Jermaine's being flattering about it. I thought it was absolutely horrible.
Oh,
like
I get the
you,
idea.
I would have
they
been
seem to like it.
I managed to stay awake.
No, I don't think so. I think they're slagging you off.
Yeah, I'm being sarcastic.
Everyone involved should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves.
They talked all over you there. I mean, I know it was Ricky's piece, but...
Yeah, but it was just meant to be, the television was meant to be on in the background. I'm amazed I'm in it at all.
And when you ended that by saying it's something that people should be, everyone involved with it should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves, that does sound like your, it doesn't sound as though Ricky Gervais wrote that for you.
Well, I mean, yes, it's not like a script, right? They just said, just slag it off. So it was fine. So we just had a slag, you know. But then so did Jermaine, obviously, you know, she was...
It's just a particularly Kermode-ish.
No, yes, I know. Well, they just said
everyone involved should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves.
Yes, and
how many movies is that true of, do you think?
Well, there are a few this year. I mean, obviously, Little Man is the.
That's Possessed by the Devil, which is not quite the same.
No, Possessed by the Devil is probably worse. Well, there's one coming up today.
Okay, no, so what we're talking about is movies with no redeeming features. Okay?
Movies of which everyone involved,
the acting, the editing, the directing, everything.
Yeah, and in fact, I know for a fact that, I mean, I have met people in the past who I've said really terrible things about their movies, and I've met them and they've said, you know, we all knew it was that bad and we're all embarrassed about it.
So what we're looking for really then is movies with no redeeming features. Yeah. Nothing can be said.
Well, I'll give you a very good example. The guy somebody who wrote Green Street, remember that absolutely horrible football movie?
Yes.
That was basically proto-fascist.
With your man from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, oh, yeah, exactly. Hobo the football hooligan. Absolutely horrible. And the guy who either wrote the book or wrote the original screen, I can't remember, came up to me and said, you reviewed that film. And he said, yes, I agree with, you know, it was horrible. They completely messed it up. And I was really pleased to know that he had disliked it as much as I had.
That's been mentioned. If you have anything else to add, so Green Street then.
Yes.
Is on the list, and we'll construct this list before 4 o'clock. So there has to be, without doubt and without argument, these are movies with no redeeming features.
Yes,
at
and
all.
People should have known better.
Mayo at bbc.co.uk. Okay, so we're giving you the top 10 new stuff, please.
Well, we'll start with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Beginning, which is a classic example of they should have known better. In fact, it's not that they should have known better. It's just to do with milking the cash cow that is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I just came from this in the West End because they finally screened it at 4:20 last Friday, of course, which is no good because it's, you know, it's to do with being on air and all the rest of it. But usually a movie would be screened in advance for the critics. But the print arrived very late, in inverted commas, so really we didn't get a chance to see it properly, so I had to pay to go and see it, which is absolutely fine. Don't mind paying to go and see it. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original, early 1970s, classic horror movie, very little blood. One tiny pinprick of blood. The rest of it is also to do with suggestion. It is also to do with the atmosphere of horror, as famously demonstrated by the fact that James Furman, the then chief censor, attempted to cut the movie and discovered that no matter what he took out of it, it made absolutely no difference. And he banned it on three separate occasions because he could not cut the relentless air of terror out of the film. Now, that is a classic horror movie. Then spawned a sequel, written and directed by the same guy who directed the first one, and in a brilliant review by Kim Newman, he said, appears to have been directed by somebody who not only didn't make the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but didn't actually see it. Then there was the third one, which was just like, you know, more of the same. At one point, it was going to be directed by the guy who made Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. Then there was the fourth one, which launched the careers of Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger. And the story was that Renee Zellweger, after she became famous, became rather embarrassed about the fact that she was in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4, despite the fact that Matthew McConaughey was quite pleased with it. And then there was the remake, with the Marcus Nispel remake, which went back and did the original, but with just more leery violence and more sexist, gratuitous nonsense. And now there's the prequel to the remake. The only notable point of interest being that it has Arlie Ermey, who people will know from Full Metal Jacket, and passingly from the remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That's it in terms of backstory. So there's the potential for doing the backstory of Leatherface, although actually the whole point of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was that these people didn't have any backstory. They were just a mad family. There was no logic, no reason, no rhyme. They just, you went out into the and there they were. And it was sheer, unadulterated terror with no explanation. But if you're going to do a prequel, maybe we can do some backstory about how Leatherface became. No. The way this happens is he's born, 10 minutes later he picks up a chainsaw, and then they're screaming crazy all the way through the film. Four teenagers turn up, they get chased around by a guy with a chainsaw, putting on flesh, a little bit of egg gain, and then it stops. It's very...
Sounds like an egg whisk.
Yeah, well, it's that, unfortunately, is what the chainsaw...
That would be quite fun, actually.
What the Texas
Being
egg
chased
whisk
by
massacre.
Someone with an egg whisk.
There's a brilliant scene in... I can't remember what movie it is. I once wrote a piece about chainsaws in movies, as one does. And there is a brilliant scene in one horror movie in which a guy attempts to back into a lift holding a running chainsaw behind him as he does it so that the security guard doesn't notice that he's holding it. If anyone can remember what that is, I don't think it's Motel Hell, which is the one in which they have the chainsaw fight wearing the pig's heads. But it's a very, very funny scene. Anyway, the thing about the original, right? It didn't have any explanation, so you're already on bankrupt territory. The second thing about the original, it was not visually explicit. This is just visually explicit. It's like blood, gore, all over those, you know, splatter the screen because we haven't got anything else to do. The third thing about the original one was it was a milestone of horror because it did something that nobody had ever seen before. It was completely illogical. It was working from a legend that actually had been reworked by Hitchcock for Psycho because, of course, Ed Gein was the basis of the Psycho story. It did it in a way which no one had seen done before. It was what Furman called the pornography of terror. We are now on the sixth movie and there is nothing original about about doing that. This is the past being regurgitated in the present with more flash, more blood, more effects, more money behind it, all the brain, all the wit, all the invention, all the excitement taken out of it. And let me make this absolutely clear. If you are going to see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre at the beginning, think, make a moral decision before you go in, okay? The first Texas Chainsaw Massacre had a strange kind of moral purity to it. John Carpenter famously said that after that film, he said he was watching that film, went along the very edge of taste, and he spent the entire movie in a state of sublime agitation. And he said, afterwards, I went home and slept like a baby. The difference with in this one, you start sleeping like a baby about 10 minutes in, because the guy finds the chainsaw and the people start screaming, oh, fine, I know, I've been here before. You are going to do exactly the same rehash that you did with the remake, and you're exactly the same rehash that you're probably going to do with Last House on the Left. If you go to see the movie because it has the name, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, in it, bear this in mind. You are not being a fan. You are destroying the memory of The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The people who have picked up this franchise, despite the fact that a vast amount of money is going to Tobe Hooper, and bless him, because Tobe Hooper deserves to do well. Tobe Hooper and Kim Henkel deserve everything that's coming to them. Good for them. But this, and I know Hooper was, you know, theoretically involved in the original remake, this is just shameful. It's just a shameful, horrible, abominable, sadistic, stupid, dumb, not very exciting, and actually rather unpleasantly leery cash-in on the legacy of the original. And here's the key thing for me. The original had nothing to do with sex. There was nothing leery about it in that, you know, in that very horror film way. You know, an awful lot of 1970s, early 80s slasher movies about, you know, pulchritudinous young women being chased around by blokes. It was never about sex in The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was about
killing people.
It was about nihilism. It was about coming face to face with this completely, you know, ununderstandable monster. There was no logic to what Leatherface and his family were doing. Now it's just back to all the horrible, I know what you did, and he's in the house alone and don't answer the phone, blah de blah de blah. It's very loud, it's very noisy, it's very boring, and it has one good line in it. One good line in it. Now, here's what I can do. If you're not going to see the movie, I'll tell you the good line. If you are going to see the movie, block your ears for 1 minute, okay?
We're ready.
Somebody gets, Arlie Ermey cuts a limb off, and everyone screams. And then he cuts the other limb off, and somebody says, what did you do that for? And he says, balance. Ba-boom.
I thought of that halfway through when you were describing
it. Well, there we go. And that's, believe me, that's the funniest line in the film.
Something that I could have written.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I think your name was on the credits, actually. Said,
Chris in Walthamstow. I've just been catching up on Mark's film reviews from last week via the podcast. Referring to his chat about Heart of Gold, and it's out of syncness. This is the moment last week when Mark declared that he was born again and now liked Neil Young after slagging him off
forever
for all those years. I've always said that the Talking Heads movie, Stop Making Sense, also directed by Jay Demme, is way out of sync. I saw it at the cinema when it was released, and it was out of sync. I bought the VHS, and it was out of sync. 15 years later, upon the release of the DVD, I prayed that it would have been sorted out, but no. How can this be allowed to happen? It drives me bonkers.
Well, I'm amazed. I hadn't noticed it about Stop Making Sense. But as I said, in the case of Heart of Gold, I even went to ask the projectionist. Say, look, something. And he said, no, I know. We all know. There's nothing we can do about it because the print. And it's way out of sync. I mean, it's out to the point that, you know, arms are coming up on guitars when there's no noise, and then it's really distracting. And at some points in the movie, and as I said, from the musical point of view, I really loved it, I actually found myself closing my eyes because I couldn't bear to watch the drummer playing to a different beat. It was very off-putting.
Teresa in Halifax, further to last week's revelations regarding Dr. Cummer's newly acquired penchant for Neil Young, my partner has accumulated a moderate collection of some 200 Grateful Dead bootlegs, which I am quite sure he would be more than happy to share with Mark.
I'm sure he would.
This is because this is perceived for some reason as the next logical
step. No, because I said fatuously that, you know, after this, it's the Grateful Dead, because I have always held Neil Young as the Grateful Dead as the two great unlistenable monoliths of, you know, of. Thank you. It's not just me. There are other people in this.
Well, Andrew Fletcher's nodding.
Yes, exactly, because everyone understands that the Grateful Dead.
Doesn't necessarily prove it.
Hang on,
Andrew? Speak for a lot of people.
Exactly. Do you like the Grateful Dead?
No, not really.
No, so that's no, no, and no. 100%. Of a straw poll, that would be no.
So if we're looking at movies for which there are no redeeming features at all, some suggestions, just up to you whether you let them in or not. Kevin in Peterborough, so I'm considering the money spent and the overhype. George Lucas's Attack of the Clones has nothing redeeming about it at all.
It is rubbish.
I'm not sure. I don't think we let that in because it has it does have a few redeeming features.
Well, I thought it
part of a bigger story.
Yes, I thought it was rubbish, but as I said, the thing that's really happened for me is that my little boy loves Star Wars, but interestingly enough, he really loves the Star Wars toys, the toys more than the movies. And George Lucas himself said that he thinks that maybe the most radical thing he did was the invention of the toys.
Steve says the cell with J-Lo. Utterly vacuous and without merit. I suspect I'm not alone in this belief, Steve. You're not. I think I walked out of that.
Yeah, it is.
I was supposed to interview J-Lo about it. And
but it's kind of forgettable, isn't it? It's one of those things, it's not bad enough to even get angry about. You just sort of think,
Boxing Helena, says Mark.
Oh, I guess, but who's the lead actor in Boxing Helena?
Oh,
I take a wild guess.
Oh, Nicole Kidman.
No, the lead actor.
Oh, sorry.
Go on, who?
Julian Sands.
Yes!
There we go. No redeeming feature at all. In fact, if there was a redeeming feature, it would have been chopped off. Battlefield Earth, Paul in Oxford is...
Ah, but have you seen the director's cut?
Of course I haven't.
No, the director's cut is even worse. But the funniest thing is the fact that John Travolta thought that Battlefield Earth was savage, you know, in the studio version, but the director's cut is really great. Okay.
So, we're looking for movies with absolutely no redeeming features at all. That's some surprising nominations. Tez says, I love Woody Allen films, especially the 70s, but his film Bullets Over Broadway is just dreadful.
No, it's not.
I'm glad he's not in it, says Tez. Well, I entirely disagree. I thought it was a fine film.
And he is in it. It's just he happens to be played by John Cusack.
Jaws 3D and Carry On Columbus added in from Rob.
Jaws 3D has got the most fantastic thing, because firstly it's got that tagline, Jaws 3D, this time it's personal. And it's also got this absolutely brilliant...
As opposed to all the other times.
Yes, but it's got this brilliant plot where Ellen Brody, right, realises that the sharks are out to get her and her family, and, you know, specifically. So what do? Rather than staying in the middle of America on dry land, they fly to the Bahamas and leap into the sea at every possible opportunity.
Jalvin says...
Oh, is that Jaws 4? No, that's Jaws 4. Jaws 3 is the SeaWorld one. Jaws 3 is the SeaWorld one. I'm sorry, I've wrongly maligned Jaws 3. Jaws 3D, 3D, that is a reason to exist. Jaws 4, this time it's personal. Yeah. That's the one that
the
has...
The 3D one is...
No, 3D is actually all right. I mean, it's rubbish, but it has got the bit at the end when...
Well, he's talking about 3D.
Well, he's wrong.
Right. You could have saved your text, Rob. Jalvin says, Crow 2, walked out of it. Horrible film.
Yeah, it is.
And
total mess.
Gladiator, a surprising suggestion from Steve Kelly. The film was clearly made simply to fit into your list this afternoon. No redeeming features. Plus, I had to pay to get into the cinema to watch it when I could have been better off getting drunk in the pub next door. I've waited years to vent my fury at this film in the right place. Thank you very much. Well, apart from anything else, that first 10 minutes, that battle sequence is absolutely terrific.
I mean, I think that the thing with Gladiator, a film that begins and ends in the Elysian Fields and has... You know, the most terrific, battle scenes in which you really think that people are getting badly hurt. I was amazed when I went to see it originally, because I was in the middle of making the Blade Runner documentary, and I didn't think I was going to enjoy it because I don't like sword and sandals movies, and I just thought it was terrific. I mean, I thought it was one of the best films of that year.
Andy says, The Bad News Bears Go to Japan.
No, I haven't seen it. Sorry.
It's a movie with no redeeming features. He says, I would have nominated Barbed Wire, but it had a couple of good points. I suspect, although I haven't seen it, that that's a sort of a slightly suggestive
Barbed Wire is the Pamela Anderson film. Available 15 now. Certificate in the cinema, 18 certificate on video.
The chainsaw movie that you couldn't remember, according to Ken, is Pieces, starring Christopher George.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yes, it is Pieces, isn't it? Thank you very much.
It also contains the classic line when Chris George, as a police detective, is viewing a dismembered corpse lying beside a bloodied chainsaw. Could this chainsaw here be responsible for that dismembered corpse there?
But it's like that bit when Forrest... You remember that thing in Species when Forrest Whitaker walks into the room that's covered from head to foot in blood and guts, and he's meant to be an empath, and he closes his eyes and he thinks and he says, something bad happened here.
Does he get the accent wrong? Like,
oh, of course, yeah. Oh,
okay, what else?
Apparently he's very good as Idi Amin. Also out this week, The Guardian, completely stupid, derivative, coming-of-age actioner, an officer and a gentleman with helicopters, or Top Gun Underwater, which I think makes it Bottom Gun. Kevin Costner is the gruff instructor, you know, a la Lou Gossett Jr., who just won't take any nonsense from his recruits for the US Coast Guards. Ashton Kutcher is the good-looking young stud who doesn't quite look like Richard Gere, but don't got no place else to go. He don't got no team spirit. But after being shouted at by Kevin, he will learn the value of pulling together and become an officer and a Coast Guard. So, Ashton misbehaves. Kevin hoses him down in the swimming pool. Remember the sequence in Officer and Gentleman when Lou Gossett hoses down Richard Gere while he's doing the thing and the thing? Well, that happens. And we get the thing about, I want you to DOR, blah, 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 blah. He doesn't want to drop on request. He hasn't got any team spirit, but he's going to learn team spirit. And there's a way to go, Paula, at the ending. Now, the whole thing is completely derivative, and it's a very bad idea from my point of view to rip off an Officer and a Gentleman, because, as you know, I love that movie. I think it's sacred. I think Taylor Hackford is a great director, and it's very, very underrated. But for 90 minutes, this is actually rather good fun for two reasons. Firstly, Kevin Costner is... I like Kevin Costner. He's a good, gruff, middle-aged lead. Ashton Kutcher has always been the most annoying presence on screen, but in this, he's much less irritating than normal. And the two of them doing that absolutely off the peg, old guy, young guy, you know, you, I can see some of me in you. So if, for 90 minutes is actually really good fun. And at the end of the 90 minutes, and I'm not giving away the ending here, at the end of the 90 minutes, that they get through the training and Kevin is going to go back to his wife, and Ashton isn't going to be with the woman who gets the way to go Paula at the end of Top Gun. You think this is great. You literally start to get up out of the seat, and then the film starts again. And it goes on for another hour. And it has four separate endings altogether. Now, here's my advice. Go see it for, you know, time your evening. See the 90 minutes, because the 90 minutes of the two guys doing the stuff, you know, that's exactly the bit from An Officer and Gentleman, is really rather good fun. And Kevin does his very best with it. And I like him in Tim Cutt. I like it in this. At the moment when it is clearly finishing, when Alaska beckons, when the reconciliation, at that moment, get up and leave the cinema. If you stay, yes, you will see the spectacular action sequence, but you will also live through another three endings. And at the end of the third ending, you'll wish you'd left 90 minutes.
Okay,
in.
So is it exactly 90 minutes?
It's about 90. Yeah, it so is. It's almost exactly.
Give him something to shout in much, you know, death of narrative cinema style. What should you exclaim as you stand up and leave the cinema?
Very interesting.
Mark says, "Leave now."
Yeah, well, you know, it is. It's kind of get out while the going's good. It's thank you, Kevin. I'm off to the pub. I mean, it's thank you, Kevin. I'm off to the pub. We'll do fine. If somebody can think of something wittier, because frankly, that's rubbish.
It'll
between
do.
Now and 4 o'clock, send it to us. And all you need to do, and I'm telling you, it's so obvious. The film literally stops. It literally stops. And then it starts again. So give me something that can shout out, and then we can all be together in this.
Movies with no redeeming features suggested in the last few moments include From Charlie in London, Jack by Francis Ford Coppola with Robin Williams.
Yeah, that's horrible, that film. That's really, when he's a grown-up, he's a young kid in a grown-up's body. Remember that?
Yes. I was confusing it with the what's the film? Is it Jack Frost? Where
Snow Dad's better than No Dad.
Yeah, that
yeah,
one.
That's, now that's a bad movie.
This suggestion, if it's true, The Nostril Picker, directed by Mark Nowicki. Apparently, if you check it out on the Internet Movie Database, no one from the cast went on to do anything else.
Yeah, I've never seen it. It doesn't loom large.
Striptease with Demi Moore, utterly without merit, Martin in Hereford.
Yeah, it is rubbish. It is rubbish. It's a shame. Although there is one good line, isn't there? Because she goes to the club that she works at is called something like Heifers, and she says it's insulting to women and it's insulting to heifers.
And this finally, in this batch from Jason, Johnny Mnemonic with Keanu Reeves, where he's cast as a genius, need I say more?
No, he's not cast as a genius. In Johnny Mnemonic, he's cast as somebody who's got an empty head that can be used as storage space for other people's information. That is a brilliant piece of casting. We need someone who looks like they've got a lot of space between their ears. Is Keanu busy?
This is the death of maritime cinema.
That's very good. That's
work.
Very good.
Thank
I was
you.
Going to suggest Shut Up and Deal, just because it's a great line from the end of The Apartment, but This is the Death of Maritime Cinema is much funnier. Who did that come from?
It came through my headset, so it'll come from either our extremely talented editor, or it'll come from a listener, and he'll claim that it was his.
Okay, This is the Death of Maritime Cinema is very good. Excellent work.
So he'll take the credit.
Yep.
It's an anonymous text, apparently.
Okay,
so whoever you are, sir, you're
Kevin Costner.
You're very, very good. What else is new?
The History Boys, big screen adaptation of Alan Bennett's smash stage play about grammar school boys in the 1980s vying to get into Oxbridge. We have already heard from one of the cast earlier on today. Barnstorming, central performance by Richard Griffith, obviously both on stage and in the movie, because it is substantially same script, same cast, same director. Now, I went to see History Boys on stage at the NFT with this cast and this production, this screen, and I thought it was absolutely belting. I thought it was fantastic. I laughed, I cried, I was moved by it, I was swept along by it. I thought it was absolutely wonderful and certainly one of the best experiences I've had this year. I saw the revival of it rather than the first year, because I think it opened 2 years ago. And I went in to see the film with fairly high expectations as a result of that, because it is substantially same script, same cast, same director, even same musical cues, the use of things like the Smiths, all of which is taken directly from the stage play. And as I watched it on film, I just kept thinking, why isn't this working? Why isn't this lively and funny and vibrant and entertaining in the way that the original was? And It's a very difficult thing. Translating stage plays to the screen takes a certain kind of magic, and it can happen. I mean, you look at the Madness of King George, of course, behind his own back catalogue. It is perfectly possible to put stage plays on screen in a way that works. You look at Glengarry Glen Ross, which was always said, you know, you can't make a good stage play of it, but of course James Foley did you can't make a good film of it, but James Foley did a brilliant film adaptation. It was very sinuous, it was very muscular, it was a piece of cinema. The History Boys as a play is terrific. The History Boys as a film just lies there on the screen. And now, I don't doubt that if you hadn't seen the play and what you were doing was simply hearing the Bennett screenplay for the first time, that there would be much to admire. Also, I should stress that the cast are terrific in doing what they did on stage. But it's not the right... It's not the right way to do it on screen. Now, I couldn't do it. I couldn't fix it. I can't tell you why it is that it doesn't work. All I can tell you is that watching it was a very, very strange and disappointing experience, because I just kept thinking, I remember this bit in the play. I remember the waves of pleasure of being in the theatre with it.
But if you didn't see it in the theatre, you're coming and you didn't hear it on the radio when it was on there, so this is the first time you see the story?
Well, I cannot tell you because I had seen it in the theatre, and therefore this slightly clouds my judgment. And I am sure that if you hadn't seen it in the theatre, you would get something from this. But what I can tell you is that what you won't get from this is a great film. It's not well directed. It's very dull visually. It's very forced, even in its shot counter shot, you know, structure. It's just clunkily directed, and it's very strange to see just how ragged the thing is put together, because there's so much going on behind that direction. What you want to do is, you literally want to grab hold of the camera. You want to get somebody, I mean, you know, in my mind, you'd get Ken Russell, you'd stick him behind the camera. You'd get somebody who had a visual sense. It's just absolutely lacking in the quality of cinema. And I say this with no pleasure, because I really wanted to love it, and I really loved the stage play, and I really loved the intention of it. And I think that it's good to have a record of a stage play that was so ripping. And also, I'm a huge Alan Bennett fan. I think A Private Function is, you know, the great Michael Palin film. This just isn't it. I'm enjoying myself when I kick a movie, and I don't take any relish in saying this, because I so wanted it to work, and maybe part of my desire for it to be better was the thing that made it.
Maybe everything else, people who haven't seen it will enjoy it more if this is the first time that they see the story.
I'm sure,
because that script sounds fantastic.
No, Simon, I am sure that's the case, and it is a brilliant script, and it's the same script. It's the same script. They're saying that it's the same people saying the same lines in the same way.
On the subject of movies with absolutely no redeeming features, Craig Eastman in Chester. Mark and Simon, I can barely bring myself to type the names Baisemois and Full Frontal.
Oh, no!
Let alone contemplate their utter lack of merit.
OK, well, let's have this out. Full Frontal, I'll give you. OK? Full Frontal, nonsense. Baisemois is terrific. Baisemois is an absolutely great exploitation movie.
Go on, you finish.
I was going to say, it's one of those films that I thought, it's so brutal and so exploitative and so completely mean-spirited and yet funny in a sort of Gaspar Noé influence kind of way. The two women that made Baisemois, I actually think, knew exactly what they were doing and really went for it, and I enjoyed it.
Robin Wiltshire, Tin Cup with Kevin Costner.
No, I love Tin Cup. I love Tin Cup. You're completely wrong.
Let him finish. He qualifies for the US Open using only a 7-iron after snapping his other clubs over his knee. Atrocious.
No, sorry. Middle-aged male comedy starring Kevin Costner and René Russo, and she says, "You have your moments," and he says, "Really?" And she says, "Yeah, this is one of them." I'm sorry, you're wrong. Get it out on DVD. It's a lovely film.
Ben McCrory in Manchester is suggesting The Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
But then he spoils it, you see, because he says, the only good thing about this steaming pile of manure was the tagline invented by some wag, "I know what you did last supper." Now, not only is that extremely funny, but I think that kind of merits, that actually means I'm glad the movie was made.
So that somebody can
I know what you did last
supper. That's fantastic.
Is probably the
I'm
best.
I'm embarrassed that wasn't me. Oh, gosh.
Okay, what else is new?
Well, very quickly, Open Season, new digital animation, voiced by Ashton Kutcher. He's back again. And Martin Lawrence, who apparently when they were doing the voices for it, they never actually met. And Lawrence is a domesticated bear who wakes up to find himself in the wild. So you go, yeah, that's Madagascar. Or it's Over the Hedge in reverse, or it's The Wild. I mean, haven't I now seen this film four times? What's the matter? Has every single production executive in a Hollywood digital animation company said, you know, I got a really great idea. We got these animals. They're in the zoo. They don't know how to fend for themselves. And then we stick them out. They're in the wild. They have to find their own food. It's really funny. All they want to do is get back home. Everyone thinks animals should be in the wild, but this time they're not in the wild. And you go, yeah, but I've done this now a lot. And it's okay. It's perfectly passable. It's rated PG, contains mild threat and comic violence. And I can't remember the mild threat, although there's a kind of Ed Gein character walking around with a gun. That is true. And the comic violence, well, yeah, not really violence, at least not as far as I remember. There's a bit of death in it. There's the implication of death. But it's mainly, can you stop making this film? I mean, please. Please stop making the film when the domesticated animals end up in the wild. Because it's been done. Thank you.
Right. Were you making that up as you went along? That was very good.
Yeah. Well, no, I've got scripted.
Overwhelming.
Like extras, darling. I just improvised.
Overwhelmingly,
yes.
The popular vote for the movie with absolutely no redeeming features at all.
Yeah.
Sex Lives of the Potato Men.
Yeah. Well, I ain't going to argue with that.
It was absolutely nothing.
It's left. Horrible. It's horrible. And, yes, everyone involved should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves.
It's a fine line, and I love it when you say it. However, movie of the week.
The Guardian, you know.
What, you mean The Death of Maritime Cinema?
Yes. Up for 90 minutes.
If anyone says that in your screening this weekend, please let us know, and we'll talk about it next week. Mark, thank you.
I'm not saying it's good. It's enjoyable trash.
But just leave after 90.
Yeah, 90 minutes.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.